Blog Talk Radio.
Before, this is Thursday the 20th of 2010, of May 2010, and tonight we're going to do the third chapter of the conclusion of Prince of Cotton and the Magic Bow. That is a 3,500-year-old Canaanite epic, which we have done in modern dress, and this is from our book, Seasonal Rites of Bow and Astarte, and Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow. And this, of course, is available from Amazon.com. Now, I'm going to summarize this briefly, and then we'll catch up with the story. King Daniel of Harnam undertakes a 7-day religious vigil, praying for his son to carry on his line. The god Baal, Daniel's patron deity, intercedes with Daniel, or Daniel with El, the father of the gods, asking him to empower Daniel so that he may sire an heir. Now Daniel summons the Kothirat, the priestesses of the moon god, to work their magic for him while he makes love to his queen Donate. Prince Akkad is born, grows to manhood, and Kothirkhasis, the divine craftsman, arrives at Daniel's house, and he presents Akkad with a magnificent composite bow and a quiver of arrows. Daniel advises his son to sacrifice the choicest game he shoots to the gods. At a feast, the warrior goddess Anat demands that Akkad sell her his bow for silver or gold. Akkad suggests that she gather materials and have Kothor make her a similar bow. Anat then offers him immortality if he will relinquish the weapon to her. Akkad replies that she's lying, and he further insults her by saying that such a bow is for warriors, not for women, and Anat is enraged. She tells Akkad that if he ever transgresses, she will trample him underfoot. Anat then goes to Father El's abode and denounces Akkad before the gods. In a furious rage, Anat even threatens to strike El himself. And she sarcastically suggests that he ask Akkad to protect him. Father El tells her to go and to do whatever she pleases, and he will allow no one to hinder her. Now Anat flies in search of Akkad, crying out to him that he is her brother, and she is his sister. And she says, go on the chase to Kort Ablim, the tower of Yarik, the moon god. Now, having sent Akkad off on his quest to Kort Ablim, the city of sorrows, Anat visits her mortal henchman, the warrior Yatpan. With him, she plots to ambush Akkad during the dark of the moon. She transforms Yatpan into an eagle and has him do the actual killing, and then She, in the form of Shumal, the mother of all eagles, completely devours the corpse. Yotpan flies away with the bow, but he drops it into the Sea of Galilee. At the loss, Anath gnashes her teeth, literally, picks up a lyre and sings a lament. She realizes that now the crops will wither and die, and she did not even get the bow. Now, meanwhile, Daniel's daughter, who has second sight, sees the parched grain and a flock of hawks circling above. The omens tell her that her brother, Prince Akkad, has been killed. She also knows that the land has been devastated. Now, Pukat rips King Daniel's cloak in a gesture of mourning. But she still hopes that Akkad may be found. Together, she and King Daniel set out to find the prince and heal the drought-stricken land. Now, they meet two grieving young men who had witnessed Akkad's murder and who say that Anath was responsible. Now, Daniel sees eagles overhead, and he calls upon Baal to knock them out of the sky. One by one, Baal brings down the eagles and rips open the gizzards for Daniel to inspect. No fat or bone is found. And so Daniel tells Baal to remake the birds and let them fly away. And finally, they bring down the great she-eagle Shumal, and they find what's left of Akkad in her stomach. Daniel buries his son and then curses Court Ablim and two nearby villages forevermore. He and Pugat then return to Hernam, where they mourn Akkad for 7 years. And at the end of this mourning period, King Daniel sacrifices to the gods. His daughter Pugat requests that the sacrifice be a blessing on her plan to avenge Akkad's murder. Daniel approves, and Pugat carefully beautifies, dresses, and adorns herself for seduction. With a dagger under her gown, and after sundown, she arrives at Yatpan's encampment. The warriors mistake her for Anath. She is taken to Yatpan's tent, where he offers her wine and boasts of how he slew the hero Akkad. Her heart was like a serpent's as she continues to drink with him. And now we will continue the story. Two of Yatpan's warriors roughly escorted Pugat into the master's tent. The warlord had been expecting Queen Donate. When Pugat pulled back the hood of her mantle, Yatpan exploded in rage. What trick is this? The queen sends a wench in her stead. Cut this whore in pieces and feed her to the dogs. Pugat drew herself up proudly. I am the only daughter of King Daniel of Bashan, she said. Well, this mollified Yatpan somewhat. He motioned for his guards to release her. And a virgin, I suppose. Well, most assuredly, my lord, she said. Why did your mother not keep her word? Well, her monthly curse came upon her suddenly, and she thought I would give you more pleasure. Yatpan poured a large measure of wine into his goblet. It was a sensible answer. An unclean woman would have displeased him. And this way, he got to have them both. For he would surely mount the queen in a few days hence. Now, with a wave of his hand, the warlord dismissed his guardsmen. He grabbed Pugat's gown by the bodice and ripped the clinging linen from her body. She stood naked before him with her chin held high. Do with me as you will, my lord, she said. Yatpan voiced a harsh laugh. Oh, I will, he said, seizing her by the hair and forcing her face down over a saddle. I will indeed. While subjecting her to every whim of his lust, Yatpan continued to guzzle wine until he was quite drunk. Pugat tried her best to be accommodating. Before long, she had convinced the inebriated war chief that she actually enjoyed his brutal style of lovemaking. My lord, your member is like that of a stud bull. But I am told that you have magical powers as well. Are these stories true? Yatpan nodded with half-closed eyes. Yes, they are. That you can transform yourself into a hawk.
Well, you laugh. I become an eagle.
No, you're teasing me. You cannot really become an eagle.
Oh, yes, I can, he insisted.
Well, I will not argue with you, she said demurely.
You don't believe me, do you?
Well, I said I wouldn't argue.
Watch, you still won't believe me. And so saying, he lurched to his feet, muttered an incantation, and before her eyes he became a very large and somewhat drunken bird of prey.
Well, that's wonderful, she cried. What a remarkable illusion.
That's not an illusion, the eagle said.
Well, then, prove you're not an illusion. Go catch us a pheasant, and I'll cook it for breakfast. It's almost dawn.
The great bird walked unsteadily through the tent fly and flapped away. Short time later, he returned, carrying a plump pheasant in his beak. The big eagle strutted proudly over to Pugat, and as he bent down to drop the prize at her feet, she poured a jug of oil over him and dumped a burning brazier on his feathered head. Pugat grabbed her cloak and dived out of the tent just before it became a roaring mass of flame, and through the inferno could be heard the shrieks of an eagle and finally the last screams of a dying man. She had had her vengeance, but escape was not so easily gained. A score of red-veiled tribesmen surrounded her. Spear points were leveled at her from every side. A ferocious figure in a swirling cloak wearing an eagle helmet broke through the close-packed ranks of desert warriors, and the pale pre-dawn light, the war goddess Anath herself, confronted Pugat.
You dare to slay my champion, you sneaking bitch, you painted slut? I will skin you alive and make wineskins of your teeth.
Lash her to a cartwheel, she commanded. But the first man to put hands on Pugat took an arrow through his eye and fell instantly dead. The rest backed away in sudden fear, their gaze turning eastward, from whence came a deadly shot. Standing tall in a gold-chased chariot at the edge of the campground was a mighty black-bearded bowman wearing a horned helmet. The first morning sun of the autumn equinox was rising behind him, and the younger man, who was his driver, silhouetting them both so that their features were not visible. But the tall archer in the horned helm spoke with a voice that rolled like thunder. We would have arrived sooner, but we were fishing in the Sea of Tenereth, he said as he notched another arrow. Anath seized Pugat by the hair and drew her dagger.
Fishing for what? She demanded to know.
This bow you covet, Baal replied, drawing the arrow's fletch to his cheek. You have brought enough sorrow to the house of Daniel, sister. Now let the girl go.
My ungrateful, meddling little brother, Anath spat. I've won all your battles for you, slain all your enemies. I even raised you from the dead this very day, and in return, you conspire against me, thwart my desires, and now you would deny me my vengeance. Damn you for a dog, the girl dies.
As the wrathful goddess raised her arm to slice Pugat's soft throat, Prince Baal loosed his shaft. Anath lurched back with a shock, dropping her knife. The arrow from the powerful composite bow had found its mark in the unprotected flesh of her armpit. The bronze point pierced both lungs and found her heart. Her senses reeled, but she would not let herself fall down. She knew she would recover. Goddesses could not be killed this easily. With a mighty effort, she wrenched the bloody arrow from her body and threw it aside. She struggled to stay on her feet, wondering what had happened, wondering who she was, who she had been. Her necklace of severed heads broke, and the trophies rolled away like melons fallen from a cart. Her girdle of severed hands parted, and the withered members blew away like leaves on the wind. Pugat took advantage of the goddess's confusion to run to the chariot, and to her happy surprise discovered that Baal's driver was none other than her brother, Prince Akkad. They clung to each other in a fond embrace. Lord Baal Cloud Rider threw back his great cloak and let the morning sun flash on his magnificent golden armor. Shopshish, the sun goddess, haloed him in a nimbus of glory that left no doubt as to his divinity. The ranks of awed Sutean warriors went down on their knees. Look toward the city of Harnam, men of the desert,
For there cometh your liege lord and his lady, Prince Paul declared. And as they turned their faces toward the fortress, a tall, clean-shaven man wearing the crown of Bashan, accompanied by a woman of regal beauty, came out of the gate and made their way toward the encampment. Meanwhile, Anath had been standing, wrapped in her cloak, while a series of strange expressions had been passing over her face. Her always beautiful features had lost their cold aloofness, and had even softened into a sultry, seductive cast. She tossed away the eagle helmet and shook out her mane of flaming red hair, dropped her cloak to reveal a voluptuous figure sheathed in sheer clinging linen and adorned with a delicate harness of glittering jewels, each marking the location of a mystic power center in her body. There was a mischievous twinkle in her eye. The goddess Astarte had made her debut. All the men noticed her graceful walk as she stepped up to Paul's chariot and slipped an arm around him. When she looked up at him with adoring eyes, "My dearest prince, you have completely overwhelmed me. You're such a skillful archer and so strong. Such penetration," she murmured as she stroked his loins with gentle fingers. "My stallion," she whispered.
"Yes, and you're making it obvious," Paul muttered, somewhat embarrassed.
But she continued, now moving her whole body against him. "Oh, I would so love to borrow your bow. And of course I would need a big strong fellow to string it for me and teach me how to shoot." Prince Paul looked up to heaven in exasperation. He could almost hear Father El's gentle laughter. "Oh, how can I refuse?" he answered her. She took the magic weapon easily from his hand. The goddess Astarte gave Prince Akkad a condescending smile as she plucked the bowstring in a subtle note of triumph. Paul kissed her on the lips. Her mouth was yielding soft and honey sweet. His passion raced, his senses reeled, and his reason fled away. "From this time forth, you will conquest on softer fields of battle, but with powers grown tenfold," he said. And then in a lower voice he added, "I will come to love you all the more, but I shall fear you nonetheless." And that concludes our modern version of Prince Akkad and the Magic Bow. Now, the transformation of Anath into Astarte that we have done is a modern edition. And I want to make sure you understand that that this is not in the original story, but it seemed like such a good idea because actually around about this time, Astarte was starting to replace Anath as the primary goddess of the Canaanites because they were becoming civilized, much more civilized and settled, and they really needed a goddess of fertility and a goddess of nature more than they needed a war goddess. And so Astarte came from a minor role into filling the major role. So consequently, that's why we've done it the way we've done it. Now, one of the things about Prince Akkad and the Magic Bow that I think you should realize is that this is primarily done to be a introduction to a mythology that we have really only really had access to this mythology just in the past 50 years or so. We just before that time we really didn't have that much of an idea what the mythology of Melchizedek's time in the Holy Land really was. This is the religion of Hiram of Tyre and Hiram of Biff and two of the grand masters of masonry, and Solomon, of course, was the Jewish one, and they have all got together, the three of them, and they built the great temple. So, at least I think that temple was built for El, the great father god that both the Canaanites of Tyre and Sidon and the Israelites of Jerusalem could relate to. And this is the Masonic symbolism, of course, of the building of a temple between two religions, and the two religions cooperating, because essentially their father god was the same god. And the whole idea of Yahweh came up later. Solomon was almost certainly a worshiper of El. And of course, the 10 lost tribes of Israel were worshipers of El. So this is a look into the origins of magic and the origins of Solomon's tradition. And it's, I think, a good way to make this lost mythology come alive so we can use it for magical purposes. Now, we'll take some calls now if you want to ask about this or magic in general. We'll go ahead and take your calls. Okay, have we got anybody? All right. You're on the air. Who am I talking with? Hello? Yeah, we're here. Who is this? Have we got somebody on the line?
Oh, yes. Mr. Runya, it's an honor to speak with you.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the program. Who am I talking with?
Oh, Emmanuel.
Hi, Emmanuel. Yeah, now, got any questions about Akkad or anything related to the OTA's mythology, or would you just like to talk about magic or what?
Oh, I definitely have a question, and I'm very honored to be the first caller.
What's your question?
Oh, yes, my question is, in terms of Goetic evocation, having previously attempted it and gotten like a partial manifestation via scarring, I would like to know, in terms of my next experiment, would it be best to try to contact the entity that I was previously trying to communicate with, or should I just simply begin with a different entity?
Well, now, we begin always in the OTA, and this I'm relating this back to Akkad, the magic bow again. We begin always with Baal and Astarte. When we start, we have our male receivers will receive Baal for the first time, because it's easier for, using the mirror method, it's easier for a man to receive a male entity. And it's easier for a lady to receive a female entity. So consequently, Baal and Astarte is where we start. Now however, if you're not, if you want a safe start point that you don't want to do Baal and Astarte, Visago is very, very good. In fact, Visago has always been considered to be a good spirit, and is used outside the Galatia by a number of different traditions. Outside of the Galatia, they use Visago. So I would start, especially because you're male, I would start with Visago if you don't want to use Baal. Now, Baal and Astara, I want to mention something here while we're at it. And one of the reasons why I read Akkad, Astarte was transformed into Astaroth. The so-called demon Astaroth is actually the Canaanite goddess Astarte. And this is, as long as you know that, as long as that's what you're going for, in fact, when we conjure Astarte, we say spirit Astaroth, goddess Astarte, we do both, and then we apologize. Once we get Astarte, we apologize to her for summoning her with such strong incantations, and whatever. We have a regular apology. Now, so I would suggest either starting with Baal, and that's Baal, that's the first spirit of the Galatians, or I would start with Visago. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, sir.
Well, that's good. And have you got anything else you want to add? Or anything else you would...
In terms of KetraCon, because I'm still also working on that, I would... What would be, like, I know it varies from experiment to experiment, but if you was to say roughly, what would be a good aim for, like, 15 minutes, 20 minutes to get that to where it's, like, comfortable?
Well, now, wait a minute. I don't quite follow what you're saying here. What do you want to do for 15 minutes?
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I said the word wrong. KetraCon, the fixed gaze?
Oh, KetraCon.
Yes.
15 minutes is a little long for starters. I would try 5 minutes at a time. You know, you keep doing this, you'll get to where you don't blink. One of the things about magicians who do this, we don't blink. At least not when we don't want to. So, you know, but if you, so consequently, when you're first getting started on Trotica, I might say 5 minutes at a stretch. And, you know, use that pearl method. Now, in Solomon's Magic, we have that Samadhi lamp, which is kind of difficult to build, and you got to have an overhead fixture and all that. So now what we've gone to doing is just put a piece of black felt down, put a synthetic pearl in the middle of it, sit there in an asana and just stare at it. And stare. This is a Raja Yoga technique. Just stare at it for 5 minutes and empty your mind. Don't think about anything. Don't let it play any tricks on you, and just do that. And that's some interesting. You will get some very interesting effects anyway, but that will really develop your Trotacom. Okay.
Yes.
And I give you that what Carlos Castaneda calls the doing of not doing. In other words, the fixed, steady gaze at a fixed object, and you don't think about anything. You just look at it, and you don't look around it, and you don't analyze it, and you don't play games with it. You just look at it, and you have that anticipation. It's one of these things you got to train yourself to do to really appreciate it. Can I give you what you want to know?
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryan.
Thanks. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for calling. Okay, we got another one?
Oh, no, I'm done. Thank you. Answered all my questions.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Call again. Now, that's the Galatia for Baal and Astarte. This is how we got, how I got started, really, with Galatia, was with Baal and Astarte. So, because I knew that Astarte was King Solomon's muse, so to speak, and might have even been the inspiration for the Song of Solomon, and the Queen of Sheba, of course, could also have been the inspiration for that. But we got started with the two of them based upon the Solomonic legend and the fact that we know that Astaroth and Baal were originally Baal and Astarte. So that's the connection to the Galatia. Now, you know, we have coming up, probably be published in, well, I kept saying before last seasonal ceremony to have it out, but too many things have come up in the interim. And we have another seasonal ceremony, of course, coming up this coming month. I'm going to try to get the new seventh ray, our new journal, out before this next seasonal ceremony, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to. But I guarantee it will be out by this summer. Now, what I thought I would do for the remainder of our hour here, was read you some excerpts from articles that and features that are coming up in the new Seventh Ray. Now, we haven't published the Seventh Ray in years, and so we've got a lot of wonderful material coming up in this journal, the material that's really significant, and some of it is quite entertaining. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little bit of this material for you and comment on it a little bit. Now, of course, we have a Seventh Ray cartoon, and every issue, of course, we have a cartoon. Now, this issue, I'm not going to tell you what the cartoon looks like, but the title of the cartoon is The Origins of German Sex Magic, so that's one you really want to look at. And now, What we're going to do in the new Seventh Ray coming out, we're going to have our own special version, specially compiled version of the magical parts, magical episodes of the famous Saragossa manuscript of Jan Potocki. Now, a lot of you probably don't know about this, but the Saragossa manuscript, or more properly, the manuscript found in Saragossa, is one of the most mysterious and magical novels that's ever been published. It came out about 1841, actually, but it was written sometime earlier by a very fascinating fellow. Jan Potocki was a Polish nobleman who was a Mason, a Rosicrucian, an occult scholar, and something of a demonologist, and quite a libertine, a very fascinating character, sort almost like a sort of an earlier Aleister Crowley. And he finally committed suicide after returning from Mongolia. He committed suicide by a church-blessed silver bullet. Now, you wonder what he ran into in Mongolia. Of course, Mongolia is the original origin of the werewolves. But anyway, Potocki wrote this Saragossa manuscript. It's a magical novel that takes place in Spain back in the 18th century in Spain, right after the Napoleonic Wars. And it's a fascinating story of gypsies and Kabbalists and secret Muslim caverns where the exiled Muslims live in these caverns, and they have this fabulous treasure. And of course, it's very, very erotic and just fascinating. I'm going to read you a little bit of this, the introduction. In the introduction, it says, Saragossa manuscript, properly titled The Manuscript Found in Saragossa, is now considered a classic of literature, and it was first published in an almost complete version in 1847, 32 years after its notorious author's mysterious suicide. Count Jan Potocki shot himself with a church-blessed silver bullet. Potocki had been a world traveler, a Freemason, a secret agent, and a libertine, and he was also a master of the dark side of occultism. And no author with such a background could have selected a more fitting location for a mysterious story of intrigue, exotic adventure, and supernatural horror than the wild Sierra Morena mountains of southern Spain in the 18th century. Like the Carpathian Mountains of Transylvania, this region of Spain was a seething cauldron of ethnic and cultural conflict. The rugged Sierra Morena hill country provided an uneasy refuge for Jews, Muslims, gypsies, and who only pretended to be Christian. The vast network of caverns under the mountains, ruled by the mysterious and powerful Moorish Gomelez family, is a metaphor for the secret double lives of these reluctant Roman Catholics. Now, with that said, let's go and get into this thing just a little bit, so you get up what it's like. The synopsis of the story. In the early years of the 18th century, a young Dutch officer, Captain Alphonse van Worden, has received a commission in the elite Spanish Walloon Guards, and from a port in Seville, he sets out on horseback to join his regiment in Madrid. Now, he journeys across the haunted region of the Sierra Morena, north of Cordova. This mountain wilderness has a terrible reputation as a hideout for bandits, smugglers, gypsies, witches, and sorcerers. But it is the most direct route to his headquarters, and as a point of honor, he refuses to take the longer and the safer route most traveled. As night approaches, he descends into a desolate valley where he finds an abandoned inn overlooking a hill upon which a gallows has been erected. The only inhabitants of this somber vale are two rotting corpses dangling from a gibbet. Van Worden suspects that the cadaverous pair must be two of those infamous Soto brothers who had long terrorized the area as bandits and more recently, following their execution, as undead vampires. And on the door of the deserted inn, von Worden finds a placard on which is scrolled a warning. Traveler, go your way and under no pretext tarry here for the night. Now, that's part of the synopsis. Now he meets the Kabbalist, Pedro Uzeda, and of course the Kabbalist is a converto. He's one of the Jews who was forced to pretend that he was a Christian. And he Pedro Uzeda wakes up under the Soto brothers, these two rotting corpses. And this is a recurring thing in the Saragossa manuscript. People have these weird, wild, magical, erotic dreams, and yet they end up waking up the same place under the Soto brothers. And then eventually the Soto brothers fall off their rotting gallows, and so you're going to wake up with the Soto brothers. But Pedro has a sister, Rebecca, and Rebecca is a fascinating lady. And now the Poles made a classic movie, a classic film of the Saragossa manuscript, which I believe is now out on DVD, and it goes on for 5 hours. It's a great film. And Rebecca in the film, oh boy, we can't figure out how Rebecca stays in this gown in the film. But anyway, I'm going to read some of Rebecca's tale here. You'll probably get a kick out of this. I read it at Bardic Circle, one of the last seasonals, and everybody liked it. Okay, Rebecca's tale. After 4 days spent of listening to the tales of the gypsy chief and reading a strange narrative from the Kabbalist's library, Captain von Worden realized that Rebecca had gone missing. He left the castle to search for her. He reached the Venta Quemada, that's the inn, and found Rebecca just as he had found Pedro 5 days earlier, sleeping between the decomposing bodies of the Soto brothers. He awakened her gently, and after she recovered from the shock of seeing, and no doubt smelling, her incubi in corporal form, she agreed to tell von Worden her story. She summarized that part of the narrative that her brother had already imparted, being the events leading up to their venerable father's revelation of the spectral brides and grooms he had arranged for them before his death. She then recounted that, unlike her brother, she was not at all enthusiastic at the prospect of astral polygamy, and therefore declined to practice her Kabbalistic exercises in preparation for the sun's entry into the sign of Gemini. Now, Pedro became very displeased with her over this, and even conjured the formidable shade of their dead father, Mamun, himself to chastise her. Rebecca was terrified, but still, she refused to prepare for her polygamous destiny. In a ruthless mood of righteous resolve, Pedro forced his young virgin sister out of the castle in her nightgown, armed only with a holy book, the covers of which were made from the wood of the ark. The ever-thoughtful Pedro also provided her with a magical scarf adorned with celestial formulas to ward off demons while she contemplated the infinite alone in the wilderness. Thus equipped, the barefoot, scantily clad maiden made her way into the rugged hill country in the dead of night. A randy shepherd leaped on her out of the darkness and sought to have his way with her. But when he touched the cover of the book, he fell dead at her feet. Shivering in terror, she fled further into the mountains, and finally seeking refuge deep in a cave, but she soon discovered that she was not alone. Rebecca had invaded the den of a nursing she-bear and her cubs. The enraged mother bear attacked the poor girl, but before the savage claws could rip Rebecca's bodice and maul her bounteous bosom, the magic book again intervened, and Mrs. Bruin fell dead in a furry heap at the virgin's dainty feet. Now, all this exertion had made Rebecca rather hungry, and seeing as how the dead she-bear was still warm, our Goldilocks fought off the baby bears and suckled on her deceased mother bear's teeth until she was satisfied. Now, this is a scene that the Polish film crew prudently left to our imagination. Now, following this bizarre episode, Rebecca experienced a series of visions in which the she-bear returned to life, vomiting forth her brother's familiar spirit, Nimrod, who spoke to her in the language of the Grigori, Enochian, but probably not the Dean Kelly version. Nimrod's cryptic oration preceded the arrival of the prince of the Grigori, Samanas. Now, this is probably Samyaza, chief of the 200 fallen angels. And it says, see, Ethiopia, and Enoch, and also beyond Lemuria. Samyaza inspired Rebecca to embrace her beauty and her destiny. And she emerged from the cave, stretched out her scarf to form a magic circle about herself, and read aloud the terrible formulas from her holy book. She then experienced an awesome quickening of power and knowledge, making her ready and willing to summon her heavenly bridegrooms when the sun would again enter the sign of Gemini. Back at the castle, and in her brother's good graces, she resumed her magical studies and practice. Gazing into the mirror, she saw two beautiful, naked, gosmer-winged angelic figures standing behind her reflected image. But when she turned away from the glass to look over her shoulder, they were not there. Rebecca got a book of poetry by Idris, and Idris is the Arabic equivalent of Enoch, and took it with her to the great hall of the castle. And there was a 12-foot-tall standing mirror of Venetian make. She stood before the mirror and read aloud a poem about creation, the creation of the world, and once again, the Gemini twins appeared before her in the glass. And although they were both nude, they each kept one pair of their translucent wings crossed over their private parts. But when she began to read the poem about the fallen angels making love to the daughters of men, they began to unveil themselves. Then Rebecca's modesty compelled her to cover her eyes, whereupon her spectral lovers kissed her hands. And then the great mirror shattered into 1,000 pieces. The sun had left the sign of Gemini, and they had departed. Well, now, I read the Saragossa manuscript way back before I ever got really seriously into magic, back when I was in college. And this is maybe one of the clues to why I ended up, you know, discovering what I did about mirror magic, because there's mirror magic all through the Saragossa manuscript. It's probably one of the things that made me realize that the magic mirror was really one of the keys to magic. Now there's a lot more of that Saragossa manuscript to come, but for a little bit of humor, let's skip over to the 1,000 sayings of the Master Gu. Now, the Master Gu, back some years ago, when the Internet wasn't quite as sophisticated as it is now, we had a news group called Alt Magic. Some of you may remember that. And I was one of the regulars on Alt Magic until it finally the trolls took it over and it deteriorated. But during that time, I created a character called the Master Gu. And the Master Gu was a sort of an Eastern sage, and he would come up with these various things. And so I decided I'd collect some of Gu's best aphorisms for the seventh ray this time. So here are some sayings from the Master Gu. The dog of God is a god among dogs because dog is God spelled backwards. The true master may not know all the answers, but he should know most of the questions. One may see the flower outside the closed window, but not smell its fragrance. Different paths up the holy mountain lead upward to the same summit, but each climber believes that the peak he strives for is higher than that of his brother upon the adjacent path. A lesser man may torment a dog, but only a fool teases a tiger. There was once a would-be messiah in Libya who trained parrots to fly about and proclaim him God. Whereupon, a rival Mahdi coached another flock of birds to declare the first Messiah a fraud. A third anchorite, a true holy man, instructed 100 parrots to announce that everyone was God. And that is why, today, there are no parrots in Libya. Knowing how to repair a current wheel is knowledge. Waiting for the rain to stop before repairing it is wisdom. The greatest swordsman draws first and cuts once. Then there was a true believer charged with finding a natural habitat for a cage of squirrels caught in the city. He transported the little animals all the way up into the tall timber before releasing them, because he recalled that it was written, "Thou shalt not cast thy squirrels before pine." He who contemplates the fly on his nose may fail to see the fly in his soup. Now, so that's a little sample of Goo's wisdom. Now, the other thing that we have that we could briefly entertain you with is an article called "The Dark Origins of the Werewolf Legend." Now, if we open this up with Kurt Siodomak's little poem that he had in his original 1941, "The Wolfman." So even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers at night may become a wolf when the wolfbane booms and the autumn moon is bright. Okay. Now, the modern version of the werewolf legend is largely the creation of Hollywood screenwriters. The Werewolf of London, Universal 1935, established the idea that lycanthropy was contagious in the matter of rabies. Kurt Siodomak's "The Wolfman," Universal 1941, gave us the idea that silver was poison to werewolves. Both films were based on the concept that transformational lycanthropy was an involuntary curse in the form of an infectious disease which would inevitably transform anyone bitten by another werewolf into a bestial-appearing anthropomorphic monster compelled to stalk and murder human victims during the full moon. Now, the Hollywood werewolf has little to do with the actual werewolf phenomenon that has come down to us from European historical records and folklore. European werewolves were not involuntary victims. They chose their grisly lifestyle, and some of them really were homicidal maniacs and cannibals. Others falsely accused in the manner of the witchcraft persecution, but none were assumed to be victims of a transmitted curse, nor did they claim this as a defense. Equally important was the concept and the delusion that the transformation into a wolf was complete. The actual medieval European werewolf believed that he was a four-legged wolf, not a two-legged hybrid beast man. However, it is my contention that these medieval aberrations of madness were a lingering cultural shadow from an earlier dark secret our European forebears have suppressed. It should also be noted that belief in human-to-animal transformation is worldwide, found in the folklore and shamanic traditions of nearly all cultures. In line with this, it should be mentioned that the most feared and respected predatory animal in any particular region becomes the were-animal of choice. Hence, we have were-tigers in India, were-jaguars in South America, and were-leopards in Africa. In the later instance, the ancient superstition provided the operative mythos for a widespread cannibalistic murder cult which survived into modern times. The tribal shaman of the hunting culture is the spiritual master of the game animals, the totem animal, and the magical preparations for the hunt. The totem animal of a hunting tribe or clan is often the major predator in the area, and the shaman is the leader of the hunting dance, and a form of ritual hypnosis in which the actions of the animal are mimicked, causing a subjective transformation of the dancers into the totem animal, the wolf, the bear, the leopard, the lion, etc. Central European legends of the wild hunt evoke memories of these magical dance rituals from our own culture's prehistoric roots. Archaeological and ethnographic examples of this shamanic magical process are well known, but what is not so well known is the use of such ferocious totem animals and transformation rituals by cannibal tribes, clans, and secret societies in the hunting of human beings. If we look up werewolf in Egerton Sykes' Dictionary of Non-Classical Mythology, we read, "The werewolf of the Teutons and the Slavs is a faint memory of the ritual dances and sacrifices of wolf totem clans such as the Neri mentioned by Herodotus, and the possibility that manifestations of the frenzy like those of authentic mental disease lycanthropy might have been brought on by cold and exposure also exists. The belief in lycanthropy persisted, and in the mountainous districts of Central and Eastern Europe until at least 1939. Now, following the trail from Sykes back to Herodotus, 500 BC, we read that the Neri were men who may well be magicians, since the Scythians and the Greeks who live in Scythia say that once every year a Nerian becomes a wolf for a few days and then reverts to his original state. Herodotus says, "Personally, I don't believe this, but they, the Scythians, make the claim and absolutely believe it. They even swear they're telling the truth." Now, Herodotus goes on to recount that the Neri lived in close proximity to a tribe of cannibals. And where does the venerable Herodotus locate these ancient lupine Nerians? Well, right in the midst of the Carpathian Mountains. Based upon the above and the remarkable modern ethnographic analogies of the African human leopard and lion societies, I submit that the real European werewolves were originally a prehistoric pagan Slavic hunting cult, or an intertribal secret society venerating and imitating wolves. And it's quite possible that they practiced human sacrifice and ritual cannibalism. Now, that, I believe, and because this article goes on with more and more evidence to this, but this is something that has not really been dealt with the way it should be in anthropology, and we seem to want to have this idea of the werewolf that can't help himself and hold and it just comes on him. No, actually, it's every possibility, I think the probability that this was a memory of a very dark and sinister cult that began, I think, probably in Mongolia and came all the way across, into Dark Age Europe. Now, so that's for our Gothic friends, that ought to keep them interested. We also have another chapter of Adamson's Quest. This is the Adventures of the First and Final Fool. We have the Kratzer Rapport, our own German to English translation of the Kratzer Rapport, plus our commentary on that. We have a great article on celestial magic that the Soma Sophia, which we've been working on for a long time. And we have The Great Secret of Masonry and Rosicrucians, and that article on the big secret behind it, which I think you'll find interesting. And we have about, my engineer's telling me we have about 6 minutes remaining on the show here. So I would like to suggest that next week, what we're going to try to do next week is we're going to discuss a little bit more about what we have coming up in the seventh ray. We're also going to open up a discussion on some of these wild, erroneous ideas about Freemasonry, because Freemasonry, of course, is the grand fraternity upon which the Golden Dawn and all of our good occult organizations are kind of based on it. It's kind of the grand old fraternity, and somehow or other, it seems that Freemasonry be blamed for all kinds of horrible stuff, which is not the case at all. And I think we know exactly why this has happened. So we're going to start next week. We're going to start talking about Freemasonry and why these conspiracy theories have arisen, and what's really behind them, what Freemasonry really does, and what it really believes, and what it really is, what its mission really is, as compared to what some people think about it. And understand, of course, that Masons, there are certainly Masons who practice magic, but Masonry doesn't teach magic, and Masonry is not a magical organization. We do have some Masons, of course, who are magicians, but the reason why we're going to do this is because Masonry is kind of close to all our hearts, and I think we need to take on these anti-Masons and explain just why they are wrong about what they think about Masonry. We'll tell you essentially what the real secrets are and what the real purpose of Masonry is. And I think that we look forward to that. And we'll also discuss a famous Masonic hoax that some people still believe, a hoax against Masonry. And that's the Palladium affair. We'll discuss that. So next week, we'll take calls, and those of you who want to, sink your teeth into this, you can call up, and we'll have a good session. So tell your friends about the show. And I'm sorry that we had a hiatus last week, but then I was over in Phoenix. We had a reunion, a regional reunion over in Phoenix with my Scottish Rite group, and so we were over there in Phoenix doing good work, and that's why we weren't on last week. Anyway, next week this will be right here, and we'll be ready to take your calls. So have a good one, and we'll see you next week.